remember the positions of these two heroes to stand by the nation's causes. Haj Qasim Soleimani gave himself to Palestine and the resistance, and was intransigent in front of the projects of the Zionist enemy, through which it wants to break up the region.
The participants recalled the actions of the martyr Soleimani and how he terrified America and Israel, which thought by assassinating him to weaken the resistance forces, but contrary, it lit a fire that would not be extinguished until the liberation of Jerusalem al-Quds and the demise of global arrogance.
We commemorate the two great martyrs, Haj Qasim Soleimani and Abu Mahdi Muhandis, who strived for God's cause and are loyal to God and did what they were required to do. God gave them wisdom and strength. They were great people and we should follow their path.
The martyr Soleimani was an icon in the face of the Zionist entity and its projects. He played a great role in supporting the Palestinian resistance movements and stood by the Iraqi Popular Mobilization Forces in its battles with Daesh in Iraq.
Once again, Yemenis have taken a resolve to continue the legacy of General Qasim Soleimani in the face of years of aggression against the impoverished nation by Saudi Arabia and some of its regional allies and their Western backers. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Crowds of people as well as officials have flocked to Sayyida Zainab Shrine near Damascus to pay tribute to Iranian top commander, Lieutenant General Qasim Soleimani. In an address to the ceremony, Iran's ambassador to Syria said General Soleimani was a symbol assassinated by the U.S. to force Iranians to kneel, stressing that the resistance front will triumph and take revenge of Soleimani's blood.
The Iranian nation will never sit back against those who carried out the crime. Those behind the crime will be punished. Iran will continue supporting Syria and its army until the Syrian army's sovereignty is restored on all territories.
Other speakers underlined the effective role of martyr Soleimani in defeating Daesh terrorists in Syria and Iraq, and foiling Western plots across the region. Representative of the Syrian army in the ceremony praised General Soleimani as a brave and wise commander who won the trust of all resistance fighters.
We have gathered here today tribute to martyr Soleimani. His sacrifices will not be forgotten. We will continue adhering to resistance as a sole option. We promise martyr Soleimani that his memory will be our path.
The crime of assassinating General Soleimani amounts to international terrorism in its ugliest form. General Soleimani's assassination is a great loss to Iran, Syria, and the resistance front. But thousands of Soleimanis are yet to come.
Photos of General Soleimani were also showcased in and around Sayyida Zainab Shrine. General Soleimani, who was assassinated by the U.S. in January 2020 in Iraq, led Iranian military advisors in Syria for years across Syrian territories, mainly Aleppo, Damascus, and Deir ez-Zor. His command played a major role in restoring stability to hundreds of square kilometers in Syria.
General Soleimani's significant achievements in Syria cannot be forgotten by the people here. Syrians have marked his first martyrdom anniversary by showing appreciation to his support and acknowledgement that security in so many areas in Syria wouldn't have been possible without his presence. Hamad Ali from Sayyida Zainab Shrine, Damascus Countryside.
People have gathered here in Kabul to pay respect to the bravery and the leading role of two significant figures against invading forces and foreign-backed terrorists, Lieutenant General Qasim Soleimani and Afghanistan's national hero, Ahmad Shah Massoud.
Lieutenant General Qasim Soleimani and our national hero, Ahmad Shah Massoud, were close friends and comrades in the region. Their sacrifices have not been fully highlighted yet, so we need to know them more than ever.
Given the fact that Afghanistan has been repeatedly invaded by some superpowers, mainly over the past two centuries, resistance is considered a familiar concept among the nation. Afghans have had some top resistance leaders like Ahmad Shah Massoud, a national hero who became the victim of a terrorist attack back in 2001. His characteristics are very much similar to that of Lieutenant General Qasim Soleimani in the eyes of Afghans.
The U.S. expected to remove the name of Qasem Soleimani from the minds of resisting nations by assassinating him. But contrary to those expectations, he became a popular hero, not only for Iranians, but also for all resistance nations across the world, just like Massoud.
Afghans and Iranians share many commonalities in terms of history, culture, religion, and security. Many people here in Afghanistan believe that one of the major similarities between these two nations is their resisting spirit against the invaders. This event in Afghanistan marks the memories of two well-known resistance leaders, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Afghanistan's national hero Ahmad Shah Massoud. This comes as Afghans themselves are suffering from terrorism and are seeking to follow the path of these two heroes. Syed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
A year has passed since millions of Iranians attended the funeral service of slain Iranian military figure General Soleimani. Now, on the first anniversary of his assassination by the U.S., his fellow citizens in Kerman have once again come to his burial place to pay respect to him. Soleimani was the commander of IRGC's Quds Force, which is in charge of conducting overseas operations. He was killed in a U.S. air raid outside Baghdad International Airport on a direct order from U.S. President Donald Trump.
We strongly demand that the Islamic Republic take harsh revenge. This is the demand made by all Iranians who owe their security to the efforts of General Soleimani in the fight against the terrorists.
General Soleimani is well known as the nemesis of the terrorists in the region. He played a key role in dismantling Daesh terrorists in Iraq in 2017 and helped liberate major areas in Syria from the terror group. That's what makes everyone question the U.S.'s drive behind his assassination.
General Soleimani brought the U.S. to its knees in the region. The U.S. sought to trigger chaos in our region by creating Daesh, but General Soleimani helped unite the people of the region and foiled Washington's attempts by defeating Daesh.
Following Soleimani's assassination, massive crowds of people in Iraq took part in his funeral service to pay respect to him. This was followed by million-strong processions in Iran, the last of which was held in his hometown before he was laid to rest.
Tehran regards General Soleimani as the architect of U.S.'s defeat in the region. His role in dislodging Daesh terrorists won him huge support and popularity, not only among Iranians, but among the people of Syria and Iraq, who say his assassination created a united front against the U.S. Yusuf Jalali, Kerman.
We're back in the eye of the storm. These were the words of Simon Stevens, the head of Britain's National Health Service, as more people are in hospital with COVID-19 now than at the peak of the first wave earlier this year. Authorities are blaming the soaring infection rates on a new, more transmissible variant of the virus, first identified in Southeast England. Dr. Katie Sanderson of the Doctors Association has warned that the strain on hospitals is only going to get worse.
The volume of sick patients coming in with coronavirus is verging on unmanageable just in terms of ambulance capacity, A&E capacity and bed capacity. We haven't seen the patients who had coronavirus infections that they've contracted over Christmas yet because they're probably not sick enough to come to hospital yet.
Ambulances with infected patients have been forced to wait outside hospitals as capacity is overstretched. Many more infected individuals are forced to wait at home as ambulances are unable to meet the demands on the system.
This is something that we've just never experienced before. Control room staff are having to make incredibly difficult decisions to decide who gets an ambulance and in what order, quite often with huge numbers of people waiting for ambulances and they have nobody left to send.
A growing number of National Health Service staff are also off work because they are self-isolating or have become sick with the virus. Officials are now considering tightening coronavirus restrictions, with some suggesting a total nationwide lockdown to halt the spread of the new strain. Britain has recorded more than 71,000 confirmed coronavirus deaths, although some question the accuracy of the numbers when compared to mortality rates from previous years before the pandemic. According to the Office of National Statistics, the spike in fatalities for this year remains significantly higher than the government's official record of COVID fatalities.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
Dear listeners, we're with you with another episode of this series. This time, we're going to discuss the late Imam Khomeini's outstanding characteristic, namely, his refrain and dislike from being introduced as a source of emulation or majah taqlid by ulama and religious scholars and his students. Please stay with us. The late Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, in spite of having high qualities of a great clergyman and his scientific and ethical characteristics, seriously refrained and disliked from being introduced as a source of emulation. There are two ayahs in the Holy Quran which point to the status of ulama or religious scholars in Islam. Ayah 7 of Surah Anbiya in the Holy Quran says that if people do not know their duties in various religious matters, they should ask the people of the reminder. Here, the reminder means the noble Quran. In other words, when we face problems and we do not know what our duty is, we have to ask those who are experts in religion. These experts are, first of all, the Holy Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, and his infallible successors, and then those who have been taught in their school, the ulama or religious scholars. Also, in Ayah 122 of Surah Tawbah in the Holy Quran, the Almighty says that a group from each of the sections among people should go and study religion and warn other people when they come back to their cities and regions. Even during the time of the Holy Prophet, some of his companions will be sent to the Prophet to other regions to propagate Islam and invite people to Islam. Referring to the learned ulama or religious scholars became much more important after the occultation of Imam Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance. This is because people have no access to the infallible Imam to ask their questions from him. As a matter of fact, the 12th infallible Imam himself, Imam Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance, has said in a famous hadith that during the period of major occultation, the faithful should refer to the pious jurisprudents as his representatives. During the period of major occultation, the pious and qualified jurisprudents have taken over the duty of answering religious questions of the faithful. Here it should be said that there are obligatory and forbidden deeds in Islam which have been ordained by God to guide mankind to salvation. They are simply called Islamic rules. However, not every Muslim is able to deduce them from the Holy Quran and the Hadith. Therefore, it requires years of diligent study to learn different branches of Islamic sciences to reach the degree of ijtihad and become a mujtahid, or a jurisprudent. A mujtahid is a jurisprudent who is able to deduce Islamic rules from the principles of Islam in accordance with the requirements of time. Nevertheless, among those who have become mujtahid or jurisprudents, there are few who can be considered as sources of emulation, due to the very strict features of that a source of emulation should have, and the heavy responsibility that goes with this great status. Referring to and obeying a source of emulation is like going to a physician or doctor when one is sick. A source of emulation is a person who specializes in Islam, hence ordinary people should refer to him. Throughout the history of Islam, the great ulama or religious scholars have often refused to accept the grave responsibility of becoming a source of emulation. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, was among such ulama, despite being completely qualified for the position. After the passing away of the world-renowned source of emulation, Grand Ayatollah Muhammad Hossein Burujerdi, according to custom among some seminaries, some of the high-ranking great religious scholars or ulama published their risalas, or manual for guidance of the emulators. But Imam Khomeini refused to do this. Late Hujjatul Islam, Ali Dabwani says, after the demise of Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi in 1961, and even before that, a number of the sources of emulation immediately had their risalas published. As usual, people started going to their houses, but it was only Imam Khomeini who neither published his risala nor made any changes in his lifestyle. Sometimes he was told to do the same, but he paid no attention and continued his ordinary life. Dear listeners, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, would be very upset if any of his students or friends made any suggestion or introduced him as a source of emulation. Hujjatul Islam Ali Ansari says in this regard, Imam Khomeini would say, I am not satisfied with taking the smallest step in my house for making me a marja or a source of emulation. Some of my friends have said that in 1962 and 1963, in many cities and countries, especially in Pakistan, they had been asked for the Imam's risala. No matter how much we tried to draw the Imam's satisfaction for the purpose, he didn't let, saying, God knows that I have not taken a single step for reaching the position to become a source of emulation. Dear friends, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, used to say to those who insisted on introducing him as a source of emulation that there are others who take over the responsibility and will just continue to handle his classes. Ayatollah Sayyid Hassan Tahiri Khorramabadi recounts on this. He says, after the demise of Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi, the Imam would often be told to take a step and introduce himself through publishing his risala. But he would say, let me handle my courses. If someday Muslims needed me, I am ready. But at the moment, there are others, so leave me out. During the struggles against the Pahlavi regime, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, in response to one of the ulama or religious scholars of Tehran, who had asked him not to issue political statements if he wanted to become a source of emulation, the Imam had said that he was not willing to become a source of emulation. Hujjatul Islam Murtaza Tehrani says, in the advent of the struggles that numerous statements would be issued by Imam Khomeini, one of the ulama or religious scholars of Tehran gave me a message to give to the imam, asking him not to issue so many statements, as he was considered as a source of emulation. When I gave the message to the imam, he said, "Give my regards to him and tell him that I don't want to become a source of emulation. I want to fulfill my duties."
The debate.
It's news that is a bombshell. The sitting U.S. president pressing the secretary of one of the states in the U.S. to look for votes and overturn presidential election results. Such is the case when it comes to U.S. President Donald Trump and the Georgia Secretary of State. Is this enough grounds for an impeachment? The re-elected U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi thinks so. In this edition of the debate, we will look at the Trump antics and his push to reverse the U.S. presidential election in order to stay in power in the name of voter fraud. First, let's go to Chicago and talk to our correspondent, Ramin Mazari, who joins us. Well, Rami, this piece of news has certainly made a lot of noise. Tell us, in a nutshell, what went down.
Well, I think above all, the call shows what a political crisis the United States is still in and how a Biden victory is still not certain. Anyone who thought there would be a sort of Christmas miracle and that the recent holiday week had changed things, it's already proven to be wishful thinking on the first day back to work for so many here. It's really quite a start to what will be the most important week in this country since Election Day. This week is really going to be full of chaos, protests, and unpredictable events. Tomorrow, the fate of the Senate will be decided in two runoff races in Georgia, and polls are still too close to call. And then on Wednesday, the president will be decided by the Electoral College. This vote will certainly be disputed, but it certainly seems very, very likely that Joe Biden will be elected president on Wednesday. But who really knows? This hour-long phone call, it's been called an insight into Trump's unprincipled bully businessman personality. But it's also showing how national-level politics in the U.S. is agreed upon by elites and not by the laws or really the people. You know, beyond the usual Trump psychology angle, the call is a genuine reminder of how very disputed this election is and probably always will be. In the call, Trump claimed Georgia officials have covered up acts of vote fraud, which cost him hundreds of thousands of votes. And polls show that, consistently show that 40% of the country agrees with Trump, and they believe that Biden's victory is illegitimate due to vote fraud. So it's not as if Trump is some sort of outlier making, unheard of accusations. I mean, this is all over the country and has been, ever since November 3rd. Nobody really knows who leaked the call. But, of course, the U.S. military establishment monitors the U.S. worse than the KGB or the Stasi ever could. So many believe it was, leaked by them to the Washington Post. And the U.S. military has been increasingly vocal and open about respecting the current vote totals and that Trump did not win. And that really reminds us of how powerful the U.S. military here is in this country. And they are flexing their muscles. And this may be, the latest act. It's also important to remember that this comes in the context of complete economic catastrophe for Main Street, total cultural division, and the still raging pandemic. So we basically had a week off for Christmas and the New Year's holiday, but this call really pulls us back into the maelstrom, which is America in 2020 and now 2021.
Thank you very much for that. Ramin Mazari there, a correspondent talking to us from Chicago. Let me bring in author, investigative journalist, and founder of DCReport.org, David K. Johnson, who joins us from Rochester, New York. David K. Johnson, welcome. What has happened exactly? Tell us what this U.S. President Donald Trump has done in this phone call with the Georgia Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, or Perger.
Well, let's begin with Donald Trump lost the election, lost it overwhelmingly. There is zero involvement by the U.S. military in this, and it's offensive that your correspondent just said that. In fact, it's been very clear that the U.S. military has no role in this, and the phone call was pretty clearly leaked by Georgia officials who taped it for their own protection. Now, in this hour-long phone call, people get to see that Donald Trump, I've known for more than almost a third of a century now, he is committing crimes in making this phone call. It is a offense under both Georgia law and United States federal law to seek to change the results of an election through improper conduct. And a number of law professors, former prosecutors, I'm a law lecturer, I'm not a lawyer, have all pointed out that this thing is plenty of grounds here for criminal indictment of Donald Trump by the state of Georgia, by the federal government, and by impeachment, though, given that there's only 2 weeks to go, Donald Trump is not going to be impeached again. Donald Trump is a man who has never been accountable for anything wrong he's done in his life. He spent his entire life as a con man, lying, cheating, stealing, and tricking people. And that many people believe there was election fraud when Republican election officials that control the election process in many states are saying that's nonsense, and they continue to believe it, is an indication of how gullible people can be. That's how con artists operate. They depend on the gullibility of people who wish things to be true, but that aren't. That's what children are.
Okay, let me bring in now a conservative political commentator and national political correspondent at the Tennessee Star, Neil McCabe, who joins us from Washington, D.C. Neil McCabe, welcome. Let me find out, first of all, your account of what has transpired in this leak, which, well, you heard what David K. Johnson said there, and what many have described, which I will get into, but first, your take on it.
Well, first of all, if this was not actually a formal or official settlement conference, it was, for all intents and purposes, held as a settlement conference, and this is an opportunity where two parties in a dispute can get together and hash things out. Typically, these conferences are off the record. Certainly, they're not admissible in court. And certainly, it's a violation of professional ethics for attorneys, including the attorney who is the Secretary of State of Georgia, to record such a meeting. And certainly, it's beyond any kind of legal ethics to release a tape of an improperly recorded meeting. In this meeting, the president and his team were making a case, a forceful case, for what they see as election irregularities. And in these sort of settings, people speak freely. That is the point. You want both parties in a room speaking freely with the confidence that everything that they say will be kept in the room. And then when the conference is over, the goal of this sort of meeting is to avoid a lawsuit, to not go to court. This is what happened. The Secretary of State acted in terrible bad faith, since he was the only one in his team. They knew there was a recording, and they knew the recording would be released. And so they were able to sort of temper their interactions with the president and the president's team, and maybe even debate him, knowing that they had this trick up their sleeve.
Well, wait a minute. So you're zooming in on that aspect of it, which I'm guessing you do have a point there. I'm not too familiar with the law, but obviously when you're recording somebody, especially of that stature, you have to inform that person. But the way that this news is being reported, it's being reported as if this is the U.S. president soliciting election fraud by asking the Georgia Secretary of State to find 11,780 votes, and then threatening him if he did not find those votes.
It's ridiculous on it. Any high school student will tell you that the President of the United States has no authority to tell the Secretary of State of Georgia to do anything. He is acting as a
But he was on tape.
He was running for president as a citizen, and he has the right to advocate for his position. He has the right to make his case to the Secretary of State. He has no pressure. The president wasn't threatening to arrest anyone. He didn't say he was sending in the 82nd Airborne. This was a settlement conference that was supposed to be off the record, and he was making his case. The president is aggrieved. He has serious concerns. There are millions of Americans who have the same questions about what happened in Georgia, and he was making that case in what he thought was a private meeting.
Okay. David K. Johnson, go ahead.
Well, your other guest clearly does not know the law or understand the law. There was no violation of any law in recording that call by the Georgia officials. And furthermore, any suggestion of legal privilege was completely vitiated by having Mark Meadows and other parties on the call. But there's no legal matter here that would provide any privilege of any kind. And statements that Donald Trump made on that tape clearly constitute the commission of crimes. Now, whether they'll be charged as crimes or not is an entirely separate matter. We should, your listeners and viewers should, excuse me, wait till I'm done and then you can complain. We have recounted the votes in Georgia several times. Republicans are in charge of the vote counting. A Trump campaign has not established a single case anywhere in the country, certainly none that would be big enough to overturn an election, of any kind of vote fraud. This is pure con man nonsense by Donald. And the caller, clearly he cites high school. I suggest the caller should go to college, take some law courses, and learn what the law actually is, because he's totally misinformed here. And I don't want your viewers to be misinformed. Nothing improper went on here except for Donald Trump's threats. And clearly your other guest does not understand the nature of what a threat is under the law and why it is illegal what Donald Trump did.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, obviously, what I said was it was a violation of ethics. I didn't say it was a violation of law. And that's such a ridiculous dodge to tell me whether something's illegal or not illegal. The Holocaust was legal, sir. The Gestapo was enforcing the law. It doesn't mean that it was correct. I don't think you would tell any of your students that it was ethical to secretly record a meeting that everyone assumed was private, nor to release
it to the
press.
Sure.
Perfectly you would tell your students to secretly record the President of the United States.
As both a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist and as a law lecturer and someone who knows this area of the law deeply, under Georgia law, there was nothing improper, and there's no reason for the Georgia officials not to release that tape. There is no ethical issue here, except in the minds of people who are Trump sycophants.
Well, I'm curious as to why Neil McCabe, again, I'm just curious as to why you're zooming in on this aspect of it in terms of the it being ethical for the Georgia Secretary of State not to have informed Trump instead of what is being reported. You see, you have all this news that's splashed all over the place now regarding the fact that they are saying that, you have the Democrats to say impeachment is in order again. You have a call that's made to the FBI, who declined to look into the matter, but did acknowledge that Trump could face a criminal investigation and has now said that the Fulton County District Attorney should look into it. So you have the way that this is being presented. Now, what I'm asking you is, what can you come out in defense for Trump to say, no,
he didn't do what
they're claiming that was obviously the law to have been broken?
Well, the President of the United States did not threaten to kill anyone or arrest anybody. He didn't threaten to send in the 82nd Airborne. He didn't threaten to abuse his presidential powers. He was making an argument in what he thought was a closed-door private meeting. And so he was advocating his case. Now, it was a political... If he said there would be retribution, or if he said that there would be a price to be paid, obviously he was speaking in a political context about an elected official in Georgia. The President of the United States cannot order the Secretary of State to do anything. He was there very much as a private citizen, and he's aggrieved. And if you were in the situation that the President was in, and you knew that there were thousands of ballots in Georgia counted as mail-in ballots that were never even folded, you would have questions. And so,
well, what did he mean when he told them to go look for the votes? Where was he supposed to go look for the votes?
Well, how about the votes of mail-in ballots where the ballots were never folded and never went into envelopes?
Okay.
That's a place to start. How about those boxes that people put out, you know, all over the state of Georgia, where people were just dumping mail-in ballots into these boxes that people were just leaving out in the street?
Uh-huh.
There was tremendous contamination.
We unfortunately are looking at just a few minutes left to this debate, so I didn't move past the second question, not maybe even the first one. So, Devin K. Johnson, I got to move on to what's happening on Wednesday, the Congress's electoral vote count. Tell us exactly what this is about, and tell us what many are under the impression that this could prevent Biden from being elected, if that's the case.
It will not prevent Biden from assuming office. This is a ministerial act by Congress. There is no substance to this whatsoever. The handful of Republicans who said they are going to oppose this are now being attacked by principled Republicans who believe in the rule of law and have not sold their souls to the Donald Trump cult. This is complete nonsense being done by Donald Trump. And just keep in mind, Donald Trump is the third generation head of a white collar crime family. He spent his entire life not making money through the competitive market, but extracting money by not paying people, by not paying taxes, by cheating. All of this is thoroughly documented. I have thousands and thousands of pages documenting this stuff. It's in my books about Donald Trump. And nothing is happening except that on the 20th of January at noon, Donald Trump will no longer be president of the United States. Thank God.
Neil McCabe, obviously these are divisions that are existence in the American society. We're looking at both you and our guest there in Rochester, who have obviously, to say the least, difference of opinions when it comes to Donald Trump. Where is U.S. headed after January 20th if Joe Biden, the president-elect, comes into office? What's going to happen?
Well, Joe Biden is going to have a really rough time. We saw that Nancy Pelosi had to fly in somebody suffering from COVID just to make sure that she squeaked by in her election for speaker. If the Republicans at any point in the House flip 6 or 7 moderate Democrats, Nancy Pelosi literally loses control of the lower chamber. We're going to see if the Republicans hold on to the Senate. But even if they don't hold on to the Senate, those are very, very tight margins in both chambers. Mm-hmm. Joe Biden is going to have a very difficult time. And he's not the energetic guy. He's not the actively moving and understanding guy that we even saw 4 years ago. Joe Biden's going to have a very difficult time.
Okay.
Because of his own limitations and the limitations on Capitol Hill.
In a minute, David K. Johnston, we have heard Donald Trump saying that he's going to come back after 4 years. You have, 70-plus Americans who voted for Donald Trump. If you have Trump, who says he's going to come back, have a loudspeaker for the duration of these 4 years, this could really create schisms inside American society. Do you agree?
Yes, I think that Donald is going to spend the next 4 years trying to act as a government in exile. He's going to continue to spread the ridiculous nonsense he's done. And of course, it's a very low energy job for him. Remember, he said as a candidate he would never leave the White House and never play golf. He's played more golf than any president by far in history. Disappears for days at a time, because those of us who know Donald personally know that he is a very lazy man. He is not a high-level worker. He's just good at fooling people into thinking that. But we're going to see a continuing effort by anti-democratic forces, people who do not believe in the American Constitution, including, clearly from his remarks, your guest, and who do not understand the law, trying to keep the autocratic nature of Donald Trump around, or to find someone younger and more vigorous. And I think that's a real threat to the liberties of the people of the United States and to the rule of law.
Thank you very much. Let me thank first our correspondent at the top of the debate, Rami Mazari, also Neil McCabe, national political correspondent at Tennessee Star. Thank you, Neil. And also author, investigative journalist, and founder of DCReport.org, David K. Johnston from Rochester. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. For me, Kavitha Tapway, it's goodbye until next time.
the bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio. Limelight.
President Donald Trump pressured Georgia's Republican Secretary Brad Raffensperger to find him enough votes to overturn the presidential election and vaguely threatened him with a criminal offense during an hour-long telephone call on Saturday, 2nd of January, according to an audio recording of the conversation. President Donald Trump, who has spent almost 9 weeks making false conspiracy claims about his loss to President-elect Joseph R. Biden Jr., told Brad Raffensperger, Georgia's top elections official, that he should recalculate the vote count so that Trump rather than Biden would end up winning the state's 16 electoral votes. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Michael D. Shear and Stephanie Soule. The piece is titled, Trump, in taped call, pressured Georgia official to find votes to overturn election. Stay with us for more of Michael Shear and Stephanie Soule's article. President Donald Trump pressured Georgia's Republican Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, to find him enough votes to overturn the presidential election and vaguely threatened him with a criminal offense during an hour-long telephone conversation on Saturday, 2nd of January, according to an audio recording of the conversation. President Donald Trump, who has spent almost 9 weeks making false conspiracy claims about his loss to President-elect Joseph R. Biden, told Brad Raffensperger, Georgia's top elections official, that he should recalculate the vote count so that Trump rather than Biden would end up winning the state's 16 electoral votes. I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have, Mr. Trump said during the conversation, according to a recording first obtained by the Washington Post, which published it online on Sunday. The New York Times also acquired a recording of Donald Trump's call to Brad Raffensperger. The president, who will be in charge of the Justice Department for the 17 days left in his administration, hinted that Mr. Raffensperger and Ryan Germany, the chief lawyer for Secretary of State's office, could be prosecuted criminally if they did not do his bidding. You know what they did, and you're not reporting it, the president said during the phone call. You know, that's a criminal offense, and you know, you can't let that happen. That's a big risk to you and to Ryan, your lawyer. That's a big risk. The effort to cajole and bully elected officials in his own party, which some legal experts said could be prosecuted under Georgia law, was a remarkable act by a defeated president to crash through legal and ethical boundaries as he seeks to remain in power. By any standard measure, the election has been over. It has long been over. Every state in the country has certified its vote, and a legal campaign by Donald Trump to challenge the results has been met almost uniformly with quick dismissals by judges across the country, including the Supreme Court with a conservative majority. By trying to bend Mr. Raffensperger to his will, Donald Trump was asserting the power of his office in the ways that recalled his 2019 phone call to Ukrainian president, during which Donald Trump pressured President Volodymyr Zelensky to begin a bogus investigation into Hunter Biden by withholding vital military aid to the country. That call was the centerpiece of the scheme for which Donald Trump became the third American president to be impeached for committing high crimes and misdemeanors. As he did when he urged Mr. Zelensky to do us a favor, Donald Trump on Saturday pleaded with Brad Raffensperger to help him politically. The results of the 2020 race are expected to be certified by Congress during a session this Wednesday, despite efforts by some of Mr. Trump's allies in the House of Representatives and the Senate, who have said they will challenge the results in several states, including in Georgia. Donald Trump said he hoped that Brad Raffensperger's office could address his claimed discrepancies before Tuesday's Senate runoff election in Georgia, one that will decide the balance of power in the Senate. The president is slated to campaign on Monday night in Georgia for the two Republican incumbents, Senators David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler. "I think we should come to a resolution of this before the election," Donald Trump said. "Otherwise," he said, "you're going to have people just not voting." "They don't want to vote," he said. "They hate the state, they hate the governor, and they hate the Secretary of State." Trump added, "The people of Georgia are angry, the people of the country are angry, and there's nothing wrong with saying that, you know, that you've recalculated." Georgia's Republican Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger politely but firmly rejected the president's entreaties, standing by the election results in his state and repeatedly insisting that Donald Trump and his allies had been given false information about voter fraud. "Well, Mr. President, the challenge that you have is that the data you have is wrong," he said. Legal experts said Donald Trump might have violated Georgia state laws against solicitation of voter fraud and extortion by seeking to exert pressure on Brad Raffensperger. One state law makes it a felony to solicit, request, command, importune, or otherwise attempt to cause another person to engage in election fraud. By urging election officials to find votes that were not legally cast for him, Donald Trump could be prosecuted under that law, according to Ryan C. Locke, a criminal defense lawyer and former public defender in Atlanta, Georgia. "He's telling the Secretary of State to find votes so that I can win, votes that are not due to me," Mr. Locke said. "The recording alone is certainly enough to launch an investigation. It's likely probable cause to issue an indictment." He said Donald Trump could also be in violation of laws prohibiting extortion, but he and other legal experts said it was unlikely that prosecutors would pursue a case against Donald Trump in the waning days of his administration. Vice President-elect Kamala Harris, at a drive-in rally in Georgia's Democratic Senate candidates in Garden City, Georgia, referred on Sunday to Donald Trump's call, saying it was the voice of desperation. "Most certainly that. And it was a bold, bold-faced, bold abuse of power by the President of the United States," Kamala Harris said. Senator Richard Durbin, a Democrat of Illinois and one of the leaders in the Senate, said the call was more than a pathetic, rambling, delusional rant, calling the president unhinged and dangerous, and saying that Mr. Trump's Republican allies are putting the orderly and peaceful transition of power in our nation at risk. Former Speaker Paul Ryan, a Republican who has largely stayed silent in recent weeks, urged his former colleagues on Sunday to abandon their challenge to the results, calling it the most anti-democratic and anti-conservative act he could think of. The Trump campaign had ample opportunity to challenge election results, and those efforts failed because of a lack of evidence, Paul D. Ryan, the former speaker, said. If states wish to reform their processes for future elections, that is their prerogative. But Joe Biden's victory is entirely legitimate, Paul Ryan said. Meanwhile, the 10 living former secretaries of defense from both parties echoed that sentiment in an opinion article on Sunday written in the published by the Washington Post. The 10 former secretaries of defense said the military should not be used in any way to alter the outcome of the election, saying governors have certified the results and the Electoral College has voted. The time for questioning the results has passed. The call from the White House to Brad Raffensperger's office came on Saturday, 2nd of January 2021, after at 2:41, hours after 18 other calls by the White House switchboard to the office during the past 2 months, according to a person familiar with the conversation. Saturday's call was the first that Brad Raffensperger had talked with Donald Trump directly, despite the president's repeated tweets disparaging him.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.